this is Graham Parker. My latest album, along with my backing band The Rumour, is called Mystery Glue. I'm talking with Rabbi Saul Solomon on Days Gone By on UNC Radio.
Oh, shalom, shalom, my friends, shalom, my enemies. This is your old pal, Rabbi Saul Solomon here of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. And I was an angry young man years ago. Now I'm an angry old man. I was even an angry in-between middle-aged man. And how do I feed that anger? Well, not just watching politics, but I love listening to music. Music gets the anger out in a positive way. And someone who has been doing that, and not just angry songs, but all kinds of songs for many years now, is the wonderful Graham Parker. Very often he's with his backing band, The Rumour. In fact, you can get his new album, Mystery Glue, featuring The Rumour. You can also see him live in New York. He's at the City Winery on Tuesday, April 5th. He'll also be on Long Island for two dates, one in Port Washington on April 9th, and then on Sunday at West Hampton Beach. But we have him here on the telephone all the way from the United Kingdom. Please welcome to the neighborhood, Graham Parker. Shalom.
Hello, Rabbi Saul Solomon. How are you, sir? Thank you for that wonderful introduction there. Let me just add that the shows coming up are the Graham Parker Duo featuring Brinsley Schwartz. That's he of The Rumour, Rumour guitarist. So we're doing a duo show, which is very entertaining.
I'm sure it is, and people have probably heard of Brinsley Schwartz. He had a band of his own for a few years before joining The Rumour. Was it difficult getting the gang back for a gig? I mean, it's been 30, 40 years since you first did stuff with The Rumour in the mid-1970s.
Yeah, we had a 30-year break, you know, a bit of a rest. We all went to the Caribbean and together in a house. It was a bit like a reality movie. Some of us were on heavy meds, so some of the band can't even remember it. But anyway, one day I said, look, let's get together again. It's been over 30 years, guys. Let's do a couple of records. So we've done a couple of records, and we've done actually six tours, three in the US, three in the UK, and that's it. That was the shelf life. That's good enough. We may make another record together someday. I hope so. We'll see how it goes, but the songs dictate that, and I write the songs. Therefore, I dictate what happens next. But there's been, you know, we've had an absolutely marvelous reunion. We couldn't have hoped for anything better. And a week after I called the band and said, do you want to make a record? They all said, yeah, without even thinking about it. Then Judd Apatow called me and said, I'd like to meet you about being in this movie. This is 40.
Right.
Met him, and we got the whole band in there. And, so it was an unbelievable reunion. Just great. So we're very thankful for that.
Well, did the Judd Apatow movie, This Is 40, did that do for you what Something About Mary did for Jonathan, what's his name?
Oh, Jonathan Richmond, you think?
Jonathan Richmond, yes. Where he kind of, he pops up in that movie and it vaulted his profile for a little while, past where it was.
Well, that film was a blockbuster. This Is 40 went to number 3 on the first weekend in the U.S., you know, box office charts, which was pretty stunning in itself. I arrived in New York after we'd been to the, you know, the whole premiere and walked the red carpet and all this stuff in Hollywood. And it was pretty astonishing. And it stayed in cinemas all over America. It was in the top 10 for a long while. So it was a hit. I mean, it made at least 3 or 4 times its money, what it costs. But it wasn't the blockbuster. That Something About Mary, if you remember, was a bit of a phenomenon, and it kept going and going. So Jonathan did got a little bit, but I certainly got a bump in profile. I mean, an old, unfashionable guy like me doesn't get invited on Jimmy Fallon, you know, out of the blue. That wouldn't have happened, and we were on Conan. All these things were gone to me. All those things were lost, and they all came back being in that movie. No question about it. And we were packing places out, and the love from that movie keeps going on. So it's been, you know, you couldn't ask for more.
Well, Mazel Tov. I mean, why does that happen? I mean, you in the 1970s, you had a couple of albums that were, you could say, hits. I mean, the wonderful Squeezing Out Sparks, and then Mona Lisa's Sister, and then you keep doing, you put out music, good music, and yet, to an extent, with all the respect, not a lot of people are paying attention. How do you go through that and just get through that year after year?
you're driven as a songwriter, it doesn't really matter at the end of the day. This is just a work process. It's my job. And the inspiration and the work that goes into writing songs, to find there's a bunch of songs in front of me where there was blank paper before, it's always the same thing. It's like, well, either you just leave them there and think, well, I've got a limited audience, why bother? Or you make a record. And that's what we do. It doesn't really matter at the end of the day. You know, there are people who have just never got a break, never had what I've had. I mean, what I've had has lived an astonishingly privileged life since I got a record deal in 1975.
So even through all those years...
I haven't had to go for a day job ever, you know. It might be a close call now and again, but basically it's a privilege, you know.
Oh, absolutely. But you had a record deal and then another record. And you've been to about 8 different labels over the years, but thank God you've been able to make your career in music. As you said, you've never had to have a day job. You could always... Was it the albums or was it the live performances that kept food on the table?
Well, the record sales for 95% of us, maybe more, are over.
Right.
Oh, this is negligible. It's about stimulating things, really. And people who get those records are going to enjoy them or whatever they're going to think of them. Pretty much, there are people who sold a lot more than me from the 70s who don't sell any more than me now. I mean, it's just flat. That's the way it's going to remain. You know, various things over the years have knocked the stuffing out of record sales, and Spotify's, you know, the final nail in the coffin, really. So the live work, you have to, if you're someone like me who writes songs on a guitar and can hold their own just themselves on a guitar, you can actually do pretty well by going out and playing all over the world solo. So that's really been kind of my bread and butter. But there's always, if you've got as many records out as I have in the marketplace, there's always something. There's always something coming in.
There might be a TV show that wants a song of yours, or a movie, something like that.
Yeah. That's right. There's little bumps here and there, and a general flow of small-time money. So you've got something. A plumber doesn't get royalties, presumably, you know. So they're negligible, but still, it's something. And you have to do the live stuff, and preferably solo or duo, because a band. I've been running the Rumour now for 6 tours, and it cost me $10,000 to put them in a room together to rehearse. You know, that's with 2 professional crew members, and you talk about visas and things. You know, the whole visa scam for America. There's just outrageous amounts of money. It's difficult, the band thing is. There's all kinds of things that pop up that are these little streams that you sort of exploit.
Well, does it?
And so it keeps going in some way or another, you know.
Does it get tougher? I mean, you're not a young man anymore, but you still have to go out there with a band, with a group, or even just solo with a guitar. Get on a plane, get on a bus, get on a van, tour. Is it harder yet, or is that going to be 10 more years before you really feel that in your bones?
Well, I'm 65 now, so that's meant to be retirement age, although not many people can retire anymore in any line of business.
Exactly.
So yeah, it doesn't really get easier. I think it's been much better for me since about 1989 when I first started playing solo, because it forced me to learn how to sing so that I wasn't just yelling all the time, and that in turn makes everything a bit more enjoyable, and you know you tend to stretch out your guitar style a bit. Instead of playing as if you've got a band behind you. So really the solo thing is what has continually enlivened my work. It's just made me learn my craft, because when I started with Aroma, I didn't have any experience.
Right.
You know, people think I was in pub rock bands and all this for years. I wasn't. I was working at a gas station, going up to London, met the right person who put me together with musicians, but even before we did that, we got a demo played and I got a record deal. I'd had no live experience at all, apart from, you know, when you're a kid, you've got to play somewhere in a cafe hard way and the long way, but the results are good, so you can still enjoy it. But after saying that, if I never had to get on a plane again, I'd be a happier man.
Oh. Well, let me ask
you. Question, you know.
let me ask you about. Thank God you don't have to do day jobs anymore. And you mentioned that you had a real job just before you had your demo. But you had, according at least to Wikipedia, some really heavy duty jobs as a teenager. Do you remember, what are some of your worst days or worst memories of some of these, you know, day to day jobs that you had?
Well, there were so many. I left school. Most of us did then in the second class, the working class education at 16. And my first job, you know, I did that for about a year or so, maybe 2 years actually, was working in a place that bred animals for research.
That sounds like fun, though. That sounds like you were, I mean, unfortunately, animals get hurt and they die. But did you like it?
No. The reason was I didn't know what I was interested in when I left school, but I'd always been interested in wildlife, nature, environmental. I was an environmentalist when I was 13. You know, we thought about it because I grew up in the country, Surrey, in England, about 35 miles southwest of London. I was born in London, but I grew up in the country. So I have a very country background and very into nature, and I still, to this day, you know, read all the time about all kinds of stuff in the natural world. And I found this job on my own, and it was only about 5 miles from my parents' place. So I got a job there, and it was breeding animals for research into foot and mouth disease, which was a devastating thing. Now, unfortunately, that place is still sitting there, and they still haven't cured foot and mouth disease. But after a year, I realized that this is the most disgusting job anyone could have.
Well, wait, tell me,
I was only 16, so give me a break there, Chrissy Hines, you know, excuse me.
Well, wait, let me, I mean, if you put, don't you just put like a bull and a cow in a room and give them some low lighting and you know, gentle soul music or something? What was disgusting about it?
Well, what was disgusting about it is it's the mass breeding of mice, guinea pigs, and other animals, and they're in these blocks. And you work in A block or B block with the guinea pigs, you know, or C block with the mice, and they get diseases because they're all packed together in horrible cages, and you have to cull them, pleasant word, when they've got diseases. You have to cull them anyway. You have to separate two-day-old baby mice, males and females, and you put the, you put the males in the jar with the chloroform because the females, for some reason, are the only ones the laboratory wants for testing, and they mush them up in a goo, and they take their blood and they use it for testing on foot and mouth disease. And so that was in 66, 67, and they still haven't cured foot and mouth disease. So that just shows you the kind of money that's being wasted. But they might have done some good in some kind of rare tropical diseases with this research, but it is a gross, disgusting job. As somebody said, we're just shit shovelers. I mean, that really basically is what it turned out to be. So my disgust with it filled my heart, and I left. And then I left home and went and lived on the island of Guernsey, which is between France and England. And my life, experimental life, started then. And I really started to, you know, bought an acoustic guitar and got into psychedelic music and the incredible string band, and then James Taylor came along.
So you don't use the word hippies. It was a different word besides hippie. It was like, was it the Freaks, or what enclave were you sort of part of?
By the time I was went to live in Guernsey, I was really at that point. I had long hair, but I'd never smoked any dope or anything like that in the suburbs of England. It was just still a bit like, you know, that's what bad people do. And then I went to Guernsey, and there were all these people from different, a lot of Irish people there. People went there to work, and it was idyllic being on an island. It was marvelous. It was a marvelous time of my life. And they were all listening to Pink Floyd and King Crimson. And when I heard it, I didn't understand it. It made no sense because I was still into 12-bar blues like Peter Green's Fleetwood Mac, Savoy Brown, you know, all those people, Chicken Shack, all that 12-bar white English blues, sort of versions of Chicago blues and what have you. So I was into that, and I didn't really understand what these guys were, why this music made sense. And, of course, when you're young, you want to out of the fashion, the clique, so I thought, well, I better get high and find out whether that makes the music sound better. And voila, it did. You know, so yes, I was a freak. I was a real hippie, a proselytizing hippie of LSD and all that stuff.
Do you regret the drug years? Or, as you said, it was idyllic. You had a great time. Did you have any bad trips, any good trips?
Oh, all acid trips are bad, yeah. It's like ridiculous. I mean, it's outrageous. These massive doses, you know, the top dose. It's like 12 hours of this, are you kidding me? And then someone puts Captain Beefheart on. It's horrifying. but it was...
You said that about Clear Spot.
Instructive. Yeah. The most beautiful moment was at dawn when you're starting to come down. You say, God, thank God I survived that, you know.
But like a week later, you do it again.
Cannabis, of course, is the most wonderful plant on the planet, so I still tell you that.
Oh, well, I'm in Colorado at the moment, so we've semi-accepted that. So you still not promote, let's say, but you would not say a bad word about it, and you think people should, it should be legal and people should do it, and you still do it.
Well, it doesn't matter if cannabis was wiped out by a plague. It doesn't, you know, it's not addictive, so it doesn't matter. It's okay, you know, now and again. It's just not, it's not at the top of my list of interest, really, drugs in any way. But what is at the top of my list of interest is the foul, vile, unmitigated failure known as the war on drugs. That is at the top. I was in the Houses of Parliament the other day, invited by an organization called LEAP, L-E-A-P, which stands for Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. You have a very big chapter in America, and this one launched itself. And because I twittered a few things about the vile war on drugs, they picked up and they said, Graham, would you like to come? So I went and heard all these extremely brilliant people, many of them ex-drug people, a guy named Neil Franklin, who was a DEA instructor in Baltimore, of all places, can you imagine, where the wire, you know, and all that stuff. And they're all saying the same thing, that it's an unmitigated failure. As he said, Neil Franklin, the war on drugs is the most destructive public social policy since slavery. And if you read a book called The New Jim Crow, which details, you know, in great detail about the basically for-profit system in America and many other of these terrible injustices under the name of the war on drugs. And we're here in England, and it's still going on. David Cameron lying through his teeth. Our policy is working. Drug taking is down this year. Meanwhile, drugs are everywhere in England. There's heroin cheaper than ever. There's cocaine cheaper than ever. Criminal gangs run a massive business. After the last crash, the financial crash, many banks were kept alive by the money laundered in from drugs. I mean, this is their war on drugs, an absolute failure, and they can't man up to it. And this is a systemic, you know, system of propaganda and lies, and I think that everybody should be aware of this, aware of the failures of this and the terrible damage that it has wrought. So that's very high on my list.
But there's also, there is another side. I mean, as a person who's been a musician since the 1960s, and especially the 1970s, you must have seen your fellow musicians, some of them, their lives destroyed by using drugs. Either they blew their minds out, or they overdosed, or they died. I mean, you've avoided that, but you must have seen that too.
What I've seen is people die of alcohol and tobacco, for the most part. Those are the two deadliest, as far as I can see. I've lost two good friends recently, one to alcoholism. He was 59. He was, you know, I was 60 at the time. He was a year younger than me, 2 years younger, actually. My cousin died of cancer from smoking cigarettes, never touched a drug in his life, an illegal drug. Cigarettes.
Fair enough.
What I've seen is much more of that. That's what usually gets people. You never get someone lying on their deathbed saying, it was the LSD and the cannabis that got me. It just doesn't happen. But it was the alcohol and the tobacco will do. There are, you know, all of us got in trouble with cocaine in the late 70s and 80s. There was years of it, and it was like candy. There was so much. Thanks, war on drugs, very successful. It was everywhere in the music business, and I don't know anybody who died from it or anyone who was damaged. A lot of people wasted a lot of time doing it. We spent, there's probably some damage because you'd be up till 4 in the morning, and to knock the edge off, you'd have to drink vast amounts.
Oh.
And you would chain smoke cigarettes. So there's definitely that. I think the biggest damage, alcohol is now known to be a toxin for which there is no safe dose. It's a neurotoxin. Cannabis isn't toxic at all. It should be handled with great respect. All drugs should be handled with great respect. This is not party time, you know. There are definitely consequences.
Are you able to write, though, over the years, completely stone-cold sober? You don't need a drink, you don't need a pot, don't need coke, heroin, aspirin, Anusol, any of these?
Yeah, you should write. I think it's the best bet to write straight as a die. But you have to remember that a lot of psychedelics add a level of something to human beings. They add divergent thinking. You never had that before you dropped the acid and smoked the dope. The divergent thinking stays with you, and that is very helpful in creativity. So you don't have to do anything, but if you did it, there's certainly an element of creative enhancement from it. That doesn't mean anyone needs it, for goodness sake. There's been poets and artists forever who have never, you know, touched anything. But it does come into the creative world quite a lot because people, you know, get that divergent thinking. And and to this day, a lot of songwriters still like a little bit of a toke and get some inspiration from it. And it kind of, you know, can explode certain ideas into higher levels. But this, I was just playing and writing now, trying to fumble a few words down, and I've had 2 cups of tea. That's been my drug of choice for the last month, you know.
Well, there's caffeine in that. That's a drug, so yeah, everything.
Caffeine is a drug. It kept me up enough to... I had a cappuccino, actually, earlier as well.
Oh.
So I was pepped up enough not to sleep on the couch, but to pick the damn guitar up and do a little bit of work, you know. So it's an interesting world, and it's a world that we shouldn't be criminalized for things. It should be regulated carefully by responsible governments, all of these things.
Well, speaking of creativity and inspiration and the actual work of the thing, you do have a new album with The Rumor. It's called Mystery Glue. And is there some sort of glue that's holding all the songs together? Is there a theme? Or are they just kind of random? Or what was the impetus behind this particular album?
Well, it was as usual. It was just a bunch of songs that I wrote. And because we'd already done Three Chords Good, our first reunion album, 2012 or something that came out, as soon as I started writing them, I thought, oh, I've got to do another one with The Rumor. No question about it. And there's just a song in there, like a universe without its mystery glue. It can't hold together too long, and a song called Long Shot. And those words, I sang them twice in the song, and I just thought, that's an interesting phrase, mystery glue. And I started to have this, invent this conceit that mystery glue, not dark matter, was what was holding the universe together. I thought, well, that's a fun fantasy, isn't it, really? I mean, it's a bit like it. Dark matter holds the universe together according to some theory, part of the theory of it. So I thought, that's a great album title. I didn't have to look any further. And then it also applies to the way The Rumor work, because they're a 5-piece band. With me, that makes it 6-piece playing guitar. And it's a very complicated process. When we get together, we take 2 days rehearsal and everything sounds like a mess. And then we listen as we work in the studio. And we throw the ideas around, and I keep stressing that the song is this. This is the direction of the song, guys. You're not getting it. And somebody plays something, I say, that's it. That's what you need. Listen to what he's playing there. And then somebody else plays something, says, what about this, Graham? I say, great. And this thing is in rapid fire, but it's still this jigsaw we have to put together. They're a complicated band. This is dense, complicated music. It's too dense and intelligent for most people, for the masses.
Okay.
I understand that, fine. But it's still this mystery glue that holds us together. It's amazing. It's like the 30 years that we had where we didn't work together as a band. didn't really happen in a way, apart from the fact that we are much better as musicians. And we're just, you know, we're very good. They're a great bunch of guys and a great band.
Do you know when you first sit down to write a song with the guitar, do you sense immediately whether, oh, this is a solo number, or this is a number I want with a certain kind of band, or this is a number that goes well with the rumor? Or is it until you get into a studio situation or later on that you're like, ah, I thought this was acoustic, but no, this needs something?
Yeah, well, while I'm writing, I could write a dozen songs and be messing around with them for a year, trying to find every nuance out of them. I've made a lot of albums, so I'm not generally in the greatest hurry now. It takes time for me to find everything out about the song that I've written, because it's a mysterious process still. It's almost like you blank out or you go somewhere and you come back with this song and you think, well, how did that happen? I know I've been sitting here playing for, you know, weeks and messing around with these ideas, but there is this song and this is, it's grown up, it sounds real. And from then on, I try to figure out where this song is going. Is it, there's a song on Mystery Glue that is just me and Bob Andrews on the piano. It's called My Life in Movie Land, which is a very sarcastic take on me being in a film, in a Hollywood movie, and it's turned into something else where I become a kind of faded Hollywood movie star in a beat-up Fleabag hotel. And when I wrote it, I thought, well, that hangs together okay on the guitar, but it could be awesome with the band. It could be like a big Tom Waits sort of thing or something like that, you know. But in the studio, I said, Bob, can you play something on piano? Just play really, you know, I don't know. And Steve Goulding said, make it really over the top. Play Crazy Boys. No, so he did. He threw in every style known to man on the piano on a three-minute song. And we all said, that's it. You know, don't do it with a band. That's it. It's great. So you never know, you know, how to skin the cat. There's lots of different ways. And I just try to work and formulate the best I can until you go into the studio. I mean, obviously, if I've called up the rumor and fly them all in, I've spent 10 grand. So I'm not going to play a few songs in the studio and say, no, sorry, guys, it doesn't work. Go home. It's like, no, we've got to do it now. I'm financially invested. Everything is a financial investment when it comes to recording. And otherwise, you know, I'll listen to songs and think, oh, I know how I want to do this. I want to record it with a drummer, live vocal and guitar with the drums. Then I'll play bass on it and I'll add the rest for, you know, what they call a solo album, which is never really completely solo because it sounds like a band. And then I'll get a keyboard player in because I'm not a keyboard player. So there's all different ways to skin the cat, you know. It's a hard work process, so that I'm very confident when I go into the studio. I don't go in there with loose ends. I go in there and I try to know where I'm going with it. And then from then on, it's up to the musicians to follow my vision of it and add to it and expand on it. And once they get the hang of it, I'm like, come on, guys, bring it to me. Bring it, you know? Bring me the backing vocals. You know, all this kind of stuff.
Well, and you keep going also back to the financial aspect. To make an album now, since you're kind of your own label-ish, is Mystery Glue on a label, on your own label?
And here's the funny thing, Sol, I'm now on Universal again.
Oh.
I got signed to Universal. Now, clear about it, it's the Universal UMC, Universal Catalog, the repackaging, you know, the catalog department in England. I got signed by this guy in England who's an A&R man. But they've been also putting out new albums by people like, they had a great success with Wilco Johnson from Dr. Feelgood, and Roger Daltrey did an album together.
Oh, okay.
So not only are they repackaging artists like me with this wealth of material, they're also saying, have you got anything new that's good? So I said, yeah, I'm going to record this album. And I played him the mixed record, and he said, let's do it. Let's put it out. So it's on Universal. And they have a wealth of labels that they own. One of them is Chess Records. You'll know all about that, I'm sure.
Yes.
And there was a branch of Chess, this kind of black psychedelic label imprint called crazy name for a record company. You must look it up and look at all the hacks on it. Many of them were these, it's Cadet Concept. There you go. The record's been out a while now, and I'm forgetting what record label I want. So it's an imprint of Universal called Cadet Concept. And I said, I want that one. It's full of these weird bands that were soul music, but the record companies had said, okay, soul music people, it's not selling. Drop acid. Make your music freaky. You know, it was in the late 60s or something.
Right.
So you got these black artists. I think there's even one by Howling Wolf, Electric Mud or something, isn't there?
Yeah, well, I don't know if it's on that label, but yeah, I kind of remember that. Wow.
Yeah, look up Cadet Concept. There's some great stuff, and there's some very... Status Quo's first singles, when they made sort of experimental stuff like pictures of Matchstick Men.
Oh, yeah.
Before they turned into the plodding boogie band. That they were on Cadet Concept in America, and there's just some marvelously weird stuff on there. And I chose that as my label. And now what's going on, to bring you up to date, is Universal are working on a career spanning box set.
Ooh.
My stuff. Career banning box set.
Spanning. Not career banning, career spanning.
Career banning, they're going to ban me, yes. Universal, major label, they're going to ban me. They've had it with me, I'm too much trouble. Career spanning is going to be about 5, 6, 7 CDs, you know, deep.
Oh, wait, I lost you. Hello? Wait, I can't hear you.
I can hear you.
Ah, there we go, much better. You kind of went far away for a moment. You were banned,
okay.
Briefly banned, and now you're spanned, so you're better. So, but let me, does this mean you don't have to do crowdsourcing and fundraising and Kickstarter and Indiegogo and that sort of thing?
Well, no, I don't, because in the what happened in the late 70s and 80s, the kind of ethos was you the more money you spend, the better the record will be. And that led us to the 80s and the huge drum sounds full of compression and reverb and every instrument separated instead of together like a real band. And I was getting advances of $300,000 to $350,000 from record companies, and we would spend most of it or all of it making a record foolishly. Now I know you don't have to do that, and technology and experience means me and the rumor, we can make a record as good as Mystery Glue, basically the basic tracks and plenty of on the top stuff is done in 6 days, because I ain't messing around and I'm paying for it. I've since quite a long while now, I've been paying to make my own records. I put the money in and then I say to the record company who wants to sign me, this is what it costs me, will you give me that back as an advance? So I break even, you know.
Nice.
And that's the way I do it, because I want to make records. If I want to make a record, that's the way I do it. I don't want record company money up front, because I don't want them coming to the studio or saying, what kind of record will it be, Graham? Will you get some guests on it, some star guests? No, I won't. You know, I don't want to get into any argy-bargy with them. So I'm the boss when I pay for it myself. If they want to sign me and pick it up and put it out, great. And so that's the way I work, and you can make a record for a fraction of the cost that we used to. And studios, let's face it, they're always struggling, so it's up to the artist or whoever is in charge to say, okay, what kind of deal can you give me? You have to work every angle, but I haven't done the Kickstarter thing or any of that yet. I won't rule it out, but you never know.
Maybe a side project if you wanted to do something a little weird and do it for $5,000 or something, do something like that. We're talking with Graham Parker, who, as I said, as we've been saying, has this new album, Mystery Glue, that you should get. Also, you can go see him live with Brinsley Schwartz on April 5th, it's Tuesday, at the City Winery in Manhattan, and also on Long Island and Port Washington on Saturday night, the 9th, and then on Sunday, the 10th, at West Hampton Beach Performing Arts Center. Now, people who listen to your early work, they might think of you in terms of the proto-punk, they call it, and the new wave, but your early stuff was very influenced, obviously, by people like Sam Cooke and Otis Redding and those albums that you loved. And yet, I was a little shocked when I read somewhere that, you've never really been into Bob Dylan. Really?
Well, no, I never really picked up on him. I didn't have any circle of out with, you know, like in the old days, the way you got together was you took albums around to people's places and you listened to them. That's what we used to do. Music was the central force to bring people together, to show what tribe you're in and what you like, and to turn up with a record by some artist and say, look what I've got. And everyone goes, what's that? Who's that person? Say, check it out, you know. And Bob Dylan, strangely, was never in that mix. And I hear him on the radio, and I knew, obviously, he's a monster, you know, figure in rock music. But it never really got to me until just before my career started, actually. It was Blood on the Tracks that did it for me.
Oh, so eventually you did sort of come around. And,
oh, yes. Somewhere around 72, that record came out.
No, actually, it was 75 or 74.
Yeah,
right,
yeah. That's just before my career. Yeah, that's the first Bob Dylan record I ever bought. But I was writing the songs that became Howling Wind. I probably started on those. The good stuff started to come to me about 1972 or 73, when I started to break out away from the psychedelic rock and the prog rock and started to come up with this stuff. But Van Morrison was more the driving force. And because Van Morrison's a soul singer, so what did I do? I went back into the music that I loved when I was 15 and 16, Tamla Motown, Soul, Ska. So those are the real driving forces. But then Dylan, I discovered Dylan, and it's like, man, I'm going to inject a healthy lot of that into my music. So I had a huge range of influences right there on my first album. There's plenty of Dylan-esque stuff in there, but it wasn't something that I'd loved him since, you know, Blonde on Blonde. I never, you know, listened to Blonde on Blonde, but I would hear Rolling Stone like a Rolling Stone on the radio and know, that's so great, don't even think of being that good. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, okay, yeah.
I kind of avoided him because he was such a giant, I think. Whereas Jagger Richards, of course, that's what made us all teenagers when we were 12 or 13. So the Stones, I've, you know, definitely been hugely influenced by them over the years.
Well, have you ever been able to meet some of your idols or sing with or play with or co-write with any of the, either the Tamla Motown or the Soul people or the rock and blues people, the Van Morrisons, the Stones people?
The Stones people, I haven't really... you know, I met Jagger, came down to the studio on a couple of occasions. I met him, and he didn't really talk to me much or whatever. I didn't talk to him. That was in the days when, you know, I was sort of didn't really care about any of it. I was younger. Now I do. I have much more respect. But in those days, I thought it's all about me, and I don't care about all these old people. But, you know, Dylan invited me in the room personally to my management. They called my management and said Bob wants him on this Blackbush Festival, which was in 1978 in England and was the biggest one-day gathering of people in the history of the world, and it was just unbelievable. And then he same thing in 1991, invited me to play solo opening for him on a tour of Europe. We did about 9 dates, and I was just thinking the other day, one of my greatest memories is in the 90s of opening for Carole King at Jones Beach.
Oh.
And I've been playing the Herman's Hermits hit, I'm Into Something Good, which she wrote, of course, with Goffin and King. And I asked her before, and, you know, I met her and said, hi, Carole, are you doing I'm Into Something Good? Because I've been playing it solo. And she said, no. I said, can I do it? She said, yeah, great. Then she said, will you join me on next to sit me on the piano and do Locomotion, the Locomotion.
Wow.
End of my show. I said, yes, I'm scared stiff. What? Carole King, hello. I mean, the hits, the beauty of the songs goes on forever with Carole King. Goffin and King and her solos. Unbelievable. Are you kidding me? So I sat at the piano with her in front of all those people in Jones Beach and tried to hold my own, which I didn't do very well, I'm sure, but...
Oh, I don't know.
I played with Niall, what's his name, from, you know, the guy who plays with Daft Punk now and all that. You know, the Chic.
Niall Rogers?
When he had his MTV show, he jammed with me. I mean, I've been very fortunate to work with quite a lot of different people over the years. The names pop up, the people I've met, the people I've played with, the people I've opened for. You know, Eric Clapton for 3 months and all this kind of stuff. So there's been definitely definitely a lot of people. I mean, my first gig in America with The Rumour was opening for Sonny Terry Brown and McGee.
Wow.
These people are heroic blues artists that we revered in England. Those people couldn't get arrested in America. They all came to Europe and played. But my first gig was opening for them with The Rumour in Washington, D.C. at the Cellar Door Club in, like, 1976. Very first gig in America. Pretty amazing. I opened for Freddie King. I mean, there's been all... I regret that when I was younger, I was very snotty, and it was all about me. I was the best thing around, and I did not approach these people and talk to them. I sort of ignored them. I regret that. Nowadays, I'd be all over them and talk to them and want to talk about music and all kinds of stuff, you know.
Well, back in the day, or people even now might sort of lump you in, as it were, with Elvis Costello and other people from the Stiffs label. Did you have kind of a good rivalry with him musically, or you were so into yourself that you just dealt with your own?
Well, yeah, there was no rivalry between us because I'd made two albums before he had a record deal.
Right.
So he was the guy who came along, and my money, basically, my manager, Dave Robinson, made some money for the first time in his entire life as a manager, by signing me, by me being, you know, his charge. And so he could finally start his dream, which was to start a record label. And he started this record label called Stiff, along with another guy, Jake Riviera. They were both working on similar lines. They joined forces, so... Well, Dave Robinson's idea was to sign all these people in London who I thought, well, that must be losers, all of them. There was a guy named Nick Lowe, you know, I mean, he produced my first album, but surely he's not a great songwriter. He couldn't be. He's had his shot with his band Brendan Shorts. They failed, you know. There was this guy, Declan McManus, who Dave said, he's really good, and took me to see him play with a band in a pub, and I thought, I don't get it. Sounds like some kind of lightweight country music to me. Because Costello was a big Brinsley Schwartz fan. He followed them around. I knew nothing about those guys, all those pub rock guys. He was the pub rock guy. And none of these people could get arrested, really. And then Dave started Stiff Records, and he happened to time it by pure accident with this new thing that suddenly came onto the radar, and by the early 77 started to really kick in. It was called punk rock. And the other word, new wave.
Right.
Stiff Records was right there at that time. And my career had already started. I'd been going for a year, so I was already old news, in a way. There was no competition, really, because it was...
You're in different places.
It was a different thing that came later than me. You know, when you're 25 or 26 and you're first year in music... It's a year is a very, very long time. 76 was a very long time. And there was no competition for me. I was in a field of one with this band doing this kind of music. But it was all bubbling under. It was all bubbling under, waiting to explode. And voila, this record label that I'd helped fund suddenly has all these acts in there. Many of them are outselling me now. So it was quite a shock, actually. But... it had to happen. It had to happen because prog rock and stuff, it was very, very, it was gone. It was over. It was stodgy, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, it blew the cobwebs off. And let's not forget the 70s in America at that stage was already about disco. So people were running to anything but disco, including punk and post-punk and new wave. We are talking with the very, very smart and fun and charming Graham Parker. Just a couple more quick questions for you, and then I promise we will let you go. But in all my digging and all my research and looking for interviews with you, I can't find anything about your basic home life. I found that you like to ski. This I've discovered. But do you have a wife? Do you have kids?
I spend a lot of time in upstate New York. Well, carry on with your question, yeah.
No, I was saying, do you have a wife, kids, you know, animals of your own?
Yes, I was married for 25 years. My wife actually works for my company still.
Oh!
My company is in the business of me, so it's not a big job. But there's she's smarter than me, so she's on the accounts. So I've got a 30-year-old daughter. Who lives in America, and a 20-year-old son who's in college in America. I'm putting money into the American education system to keep my son intelligent, hopefully. He's doing film in Sunni Purchase in Westchester, New York.
Yeah.
So I've been a bi-Atlantic person for a long time, but I spent many years in the U.S. and upstate New York. I love a lot. I based myself in London for the last 4 years or so. I'm going to be back in upstate New York in the country for 4 months coming up soon. The tour's starting, so I want to enjoy some summer up there.
Sure.
Tour goes through April, and then I've got some time to spend, and we'll be doing maybe some solo gigs in May. So as I said, I might dream about retiring, but I have a very complex and complicated life. At the same time, I spend a lot of time on the couch watching TV, so don't worry about me.
Oh, and not worried at all. I'm just wondering you mentioned you were married for 25 years, but your wife still works for the company. Was that strange or no big deal at all?
No, we're friends, and the whole thing is about the kids. It should always be about the kids. They should come first on this planet Earth. And they're really great, unbelievable, brilliant kids. And my son's like a foot taller than me, which is absurd. That's, you know.
Well, how tall are you?
I'm only about 5'6", 5'6½, not just 5'6", I'll tell you.
Well, I'm 5'2½", so that should tell you something. You tower over me, my friend.
Okay. Well, I'm sure we've got to stick together as your people.
Indeed. Absolutely. So... just a last thing for Graham Park. You've not only written songs, you've even written short stories and a novel. You did a thing where you had short stories in a book, and you wrote a song for almost every story, and you kind of went on tour, and you even did a documentary about that. Is, since you mentioned Carole King, have you thought about writing maybe a musical?
Oh, for God, no, I haven't. I really have not. That's something you never know. You don't know what's around the corner in this life. Yes, I wrote this short story collection called Carp Fishing on Valium, which actually went from hardcover to paperback. So it was a bit of a minor success in the year 2000 onward. And now it's back on sale with three new stories added to it on my website, grahamparker.net, by the way. www.grahamparker.net, and go there and look at the tour page to find out exactly where me and Brinsley are going to be playing. And I wrote songs to go with that, and went out in the 2000-2001 and did some club dates reading from the book and singing these songs. And I put an album out, which is also only available ever on the grahamparker.net. There's tons of albums on that website, by the way, that aren't on record labels per se.
Ooh.
They're on my own Up Yours Records, or the website manager has Quake Records. And these are, for me, lots of solo stuff or live with the band. There's a box set of Live with the Rumour from 1979 onwards. There's all kinds of interesting stuff. It's basically what I call peripheral music. Because I've been so prolific over the years, I've got so much stuff, it's nice to put these little things out on a website and say they're on here, you can get them on Amazon, I guess, you know. And I leave my website manager, a great guy named John, to deal with it. He's dealt with this website since before I knew what the internet was. You know, he's one of those guys.
Right.
He was out of the starting gates very quick. I think he started the first Dylan site as well.
Oh.
You know, he's brilliant, John Howells. So there's a lot of things that add up to a life. But a musical is not really, the theatre isn't my favourite medium, but you never know what's going to turn you around. You never know if you're going to meet that lady who says, I'd love to go to the theatre, and you're going to say, oh, so do I. Oh, yes, I'd love to take you to the theatre. Unlikely, but, you know, keep your options open on the theatre, people.
I mean,
you never know when you might get to like it.
For the right girl, I even go curling. I mean, seriously, on the ice and everything, you know, with the broom and the shoes. I would do it.
Good for you, man. No, I have a steady girlfriend I've had for some time.
So,
I'm quite happy at the moment, thank you. No complications, thank you very much. Too old for it.
Right. At a certain age, you put up with each other, and that's enough. So
it's a bit simple. No, what you do is you don't actually live together. You just get together.
Oh, there you go. So you're basically...
You try that one, that will work.
The boogie call thing, it totally works. Absolutely. Our last question for the wonderful Graham Parker is, if you could pick two lesser-known songs of yours that you wish everybody knew, that could be really commercial hits, or just getting, even if they're not big commercial hits, but even for a more indie, intelligent fan base that people may not know of yours, what would those songs be?
Oof, well, it's that's something that would probably change by the day or week or year or whatever. And some of my fans who are really big fans have some albums but don't have others, so they would have missed things. Everybody's going to miss something unless they're those people who are the completists who must have everything, you know.
Right.
Funnily enough, Mike Gent, a guy, a musician I've worked with a lot from his band The Figs, F-I-G-G-S, he threw me a link to a YouTube thing, and he said, oh, this is good. And it was me and him in a band that I dubbed The Latest Clowns, playing, promoting songs from Don't Tell Columbus, one of my absolute strongest records. And it was us playing The Other Side of the Reservoir live. And it's very Van Morrison-y. It's you know, even at the end I'm shouting, it's too late to stop now. You know, and I'm throwing in a bit of the Stones' Moonlight Mile at the end.
Ooh.
And stuff like that. And it's a brilliant live take of The Other Side of the Reservoir on YouTube with The Latest Clowns. And that's a song that people who understand that I'm a ballad writer as much as anything should check out. And another one will be, there's so many songs, man, I get them mixed up with off of Mystery Glue, track one, side one.
Oh, okay.
Into the Transit of Venus, it's called. Transit of Venus. And it's beautiful. It's basically, if Elton John could write a melody this good these days, which he can't. He can't, can he? Has he released? Actually, he's got a new album out, but nobody cares.
How?
The thing is, the same thing with me. I've got a new album out, but nobody cares. They're like, oh, come on, all we care about is your first four albums. You can't be good anymore, can you?
Well, yeah, but you're literally saying that about Elton John. You're trying to prove it is not true about you. So, woo.
I'm being mean, aren't I?
A bit. You've been so sweet about everybody. Ooh, do you want to talk dirt about anybody else?
Punk, do you want the punk to come out?
Well, I don't know. Say something horrible about John Cage. I don't know.
John Cage is a high school trumpeter. Oh, no, that's what he said about Wynton Marsalis. Sorry.
All right. So at the very end, the venom comes out. I guess that's the real mystery glue.
It's via John Cage. That's what he said about Wynton Marsalis. He's a good high school trumpeter, and he's right.
Well, I didn't realize that. I didn't know that there was a historical thing that Cage said about that.
Yeah.
Was like, oops.
It's a sweet one, man. It's a sweet zinger.
Ooh, yeah. Ooh, ouch. Do you have zingers about anybody else?
No. Elton John is one of the finest pop songwriters ever. But if he listened to Transit of Venus, he'd say, I should do that song.
Okay, well, that's a little nicer. That's
a bit more pleasant.
Indeed. Well, look,
I'm dying to put the kettle on and get another cup of tea going. You've kept me for an hour here, so what are you doing?
I'm terribly sorry. Well, no, I'm not sorry at all, because it's been so much fun talking to Graham Parker. Please go to grahamparker.net and buy all his music over the years. It's all there, the rarities, the stuff that's more well-known. And, of course, you're now going to want to see him live on Tuesday at City Winery in Manhattan, and then Saturday in Port Washington, Sunday in West Hampton Beach, and we thank you. Go get that tea, and go write some more songs.
Rabbi Sol, you're a gem. Thank you, man. I really appreciate your support, and onwards and upwards, okay, buddy? Keep well.
Likewise, and shalom to you.
Shalom.